Blog Talk Radio.
Wide Open Radio. I'm your host, Susie Bonham Craig, and today I have an esteemed guest, Mr. Tom Rutledge, and we're going to be discussing embracing fear and how we can actually turn what scares us into our greatest gift. And I just want to give you a little introduction about Tom. He's an LCSW, which I believe is a licensed social worker and psychotherapist in Nashville, Tennessee. And he's the author of several books, including Embracing Fear, which we'll be talking about this evening, How to Change What Scares Us into Our Greatest Gift. He's also the author of Simple Truth, which Ideas for Experiencing Humans from Less Than Perfect Families. And Tom also speaks internationally about his innovative approach to resolving issues related to addiction, eating disorders, and self-sabotage. And I'd just like to mention that Debbie Ford had written a testimonial on the back cover of Embracing Fear, which is Tom's book, stating that embracing fear offers tools and encouragement to help us face, understand, and learn from the walls of fear that keep us from moving forward in our lives. So I'd like to bring on Tom now to share with us, and we'll journey with him through this next hour. Welcome, Tom.
Well, thanks, Susie. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I'm excited about having you here. You know, I mentioned earlier when I was speaking with you that I took a trip through the bookstore today and I entered the self-help section and I picked up, had to be about 40, 50 books, just looked briefly through them and realized that this element of fear is really at the core of human psyche. And there really isn't one book out there that doesn't address some type of fear that we're either looking to deal with, to avoid, or to transcend. So I'd like if you could just share with our listeners a little bit about how you got into, or really why you're specifying, why you're getting into the root of fear.
Well, I think it's a little bit of across time for me, what you experienced today in the bookstore. I think that as I've been in this business in one form or another as a psychotherapist for 30 years, and I think what happened is, as you move farther and farther into this and you work on this and you look at it from this angle and that angle, what you discover is exactly what you discovered in the bookstore, is that the common denominator is fear. It's the one thing we all have in common. It doesn't matter, what culture we come from. It doesn't matter what socioeconomic status we have. It's like we all have fear. Our fears may be different, and we share a lot of them in common. Many of them are quite different from one another. But after working with addictions, eating disorders, focusing an awful lot, and of course I do still, on self-compassion, what I discover is underneath all of that, including underneath that self-criticism, that self-condemnation, is fear. And my belief is, if we can, as I approach people in therapy or in workshops, if I'm asking, what I'm asking in my head all the time is, okay, what fear are we dealing with? What are we afraid of? And because I really do believe if we can address that, then what we really have is a way of healing from the inside out.
Okay. Well, can we start out talking a little bit about the differences between, I guess there are two types of categories, I guess you would call them, regarding fear. You know, we're not just talking about our societal culture today, but,
right.
I mean, fear has been around a really, really long time.
That's right. Well, like we say, I think we can just go ahead and just attach it to human and realize, or at least, you know, of course, or you know, all animals experience fear, but what we find is that our you know, my dog tends to be less neurotic than I am. My dog tends to be afraid when there's actually something to be afraid of, whereas, you know, I have this wonderful, amazing big brain that can make up stories and scare me even if there isn't anything to be afraid of. So that's what we do with our wonderful human intelligence. But the two, you know, what I do in Embracing Fear is I start by saying that we have to determine, you have to be able to tell the difference between legitimate and healthy fear, really, and neurotic fear. Neurotic fear is that fear we have when we're making up stories and scaring the crap out of ourselves. And the healthy fears are the things that we really do need to face and not try to avoid.
Okay, so Let's springboard from that a little bit with regard to avoiding fear. I mean, you know, I know for several years now there's been posters, commercials, you know, you name it. I see it on bumper stickers and things about no fear.
Right.
And it's a great affirmation, I think. But what happens is, you know, I tend to see people, and I've even tried this myself as far as trying to negate fear,
right.
And that if you just start out saying, I'm not going to fear anything, that there's some kind of bypass that happens to us. Can you give us a little insight?
Yeah, I just agree with you that there really is no bypass. I mean, actually, the term, the affirmation of no fear actually shows up fairly early. This is one of those things where editing isn't always a process. I would change a little bit of this in the book, but when I use the no fear, but when I describe that in the book is no fear means you're saying no to fear's control. Because one of the most important things I want people to know is that I call it good news and bad news. The bad news is if you've come to me to get rid of your fear, I can't help you. I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to get rid of that. We can talk about that in a minute, but I don't know how to get rid of anything. But the good news is you don't have to, because what I teach people through a process that I refer to as intrapersonal therapy is to actually see themselves in relationship to their fear. So the fear can be there, the message of fear, what they're afraid of can be there, and then now I have an opportunity and a responsibility to respond to the fear. Literally the meaning of the word responsibility, the ability to respond. And by responding differently to my fear is how, basically, that's the definition of courage.
Okay. I love that. I mean, I feel that I've been courageous in my life with certain times because I understand that I had a fear about something.
Right.
But what about people that are not really sure what the block is? Is it usually fear?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be, you're going to follow it down to something. I call it going down the ladder. It's like, you know, first of all, I think sometimes we make the mistake, people will make the mistake of looking for we're all contaminated a bit by the Hollywood model of everything. And you know, we've all seen therapy and in the movies through the years. And I think people look for it to be a lot more dramatic sometimes than it is. And it's not always, sometimes it's something quite dramatic and cathartic, but a lot of times if you want to explore your fears, the place to start are to look at your day-to-day anxieties and worries. Worry, for instance, is not, we're so used to it, we're so habituated to just constant worry that we don't even consider that fear anymore. One of the strange compliments or something I got when I first brought out the book is I had people come up to me and say, Tom, I didn't know I was afraid until I read your book. And, you know, being a good codependent, I immediately apologized because I thought, oh, my God, I've scared them. I didn't mean to do that. But what they were really talking about was an increase in their awareness. They became aware that they're fretting on a day-to-day basis. That sometimes people just experience it as, I call it, that Monday morning feeling. You know, here comes the you know, it's a school day again. Here we go again. We don't see that as fear, but what it is a constant leak. It's a little bit like there's a hole in my gas tank, and I can't really figure out why I'm getting such bad gas mileage. So So what I want to do is I want to help people begin to take a look at some of those small, what they think of as their smaller fears, and see if we can't track down something below those that are a little bit even deeper.
Okay, so is it safe to say that the little fears that encompass our daily lives stem from larger fears?
Yeah, I think ultimately, as corny as it is, it's like, you know, if somebody, I do a lot of the work that I do different, a lot of different kinds of therapy through the years, but a lot of through these years done a lot of long-term psychotherapy that, you know, very often comes down to some pretty amazing and interesting existential discussions of life and meaning. And I love that part, and I think that's one of the my favorite parts of doing this work. We can do, I might do something, you know, something very practical, just problem solving one day, and then another time we might be talking about something deeper. But ultimately, when we're talking about real fear, we're getting down underneath there, we're talking about people who confront, in the bigger way, we're talking about people who are confronting the very meaning of their life. You know, one of the fears that I focus on with people a lot is not what people often think about fear, but I say it's one of the healthy fears. It's the healthy fear of not living according to your own value system. It's like I tell people that fear is a little bit like the rumble strips on the side of the road when you space out on the highway and you run off the road and it rumbles and gets rough and it tells you to get back on the road. That fear, that healthy fear that says, you know, somehow you've gotten off track with your life. You know, a lot of times we live a lot of our lives, early on in our lives, we live by default rather than decision, and we wake up somewhere along the line and realize, wait a minute, I'm not living the life that I want to live. I'm not living the life that I meant to live. And as a result, we feel that. We may or may not experience it in our head or think of it as fear, but we feel that anxiety, that difficulty, and we generally will have, this is oversimplified, but we'll have a choice. We can either begin to shut that down and hide from it, or hide it from ourselves, or we can do the brave thing and face our fear and say, okay, I need to take a look at the fact that, whatever, I'm, you know, 39 years old and looking at my life and thinking, this is not what I had in mind. And I it's time for me to take an inventory and see what I can do about this.
Okay, Tom, but you spoke earlier about values and your own value system and not being aligned with that.
Right.
Now, you know, I think part of our journeys is really trying to discover and unravel what that is, because I have what I refer to as installation bases. There are these memory collections that we have, and we've built up this huge escrow of, you know, what we've been taught, what we adhere to, both in our parental upbringings, you know, our family traditions, our society, as well as our religious beliefs. And how does one know when they're not, you know, they were aligned with a value? How do they know that value is truth to them?
Well, that's great, because that's a good point, because that's one of the questions. What you just asked I love questions. Questions are the tools of healing. And what you just asked really is essentially one of what I call a magnet question. It's a question that you can use over and over and again, and it will attract information. You know, and basically to boil that question you're asking down is, when you're aware of something that is a value, this is important to me. You know, as we wake up in life, what we do is ask, is this my value? It's like, and I mean, it's an extremely subjective thing. No one can answer that for us. But because all of us, I mean, somebody who tells me that they can't give me an example of this, I think is not paying attention. All of us grow up and find ourselves in our adult life somewhere along the line and realize we have certain belief systems that are not ours. They simply were given to us, and we just accepted them without thinking. You know, and so part of that process is what you're describing, is being able to go back and say, no, there is nothing here that cannot be examined and re-examined. And so we want to look at what it is, what is important to me, what matters to me. So, and the other question I think is really wonderful around this is, I always encourage people to keep asking the question, what do I want? What do I want? We're really trained away from that word want, but that also will tell us what matters to us.
Okay, so here we are, you know, you wake up in the morning and there's something to do that you've never done before. It's an opportunity that you have that came your way. And right away, we start asking ourselves the questions. Is this
right.
of value to me? Is this aligned with who I really am? Mm-hmm. And I really want to make a go of this, but I have no idea where it's going to take me. What's usually the first thing that kind of builds the wall in front of us? So
well, I think that one of the first things, and I think it's really perfectionism. A lot of times people think that perfectionism is, you know, certain people, I'm not a perfectionist. But all of us have some level of that because we live in a perfectionistic culture. And the way you know that is because what happens is we get paralyzed in those places that you're describing because we stop and we're having to make choices. Do I want to go this way or that way? Do I think this is important to me or not? And because we become what we become afraid of at that point, with that neurotic fear happens, is we are afraid of making a mistake, and when we're afraid of getting the wrong answer. I mean, most everybody can identify with this idea of how much time have you spent in your life frozen because you're afraid of making the wrong choice. And so one of the things that I really want to help people do is free themselves up to explore, see their life as a experiment, as a creative process, so that, I mean, obviously we have to be careful of, you know, not make rash decisions and things like that, but there are a lot of things we could do just to explore different possibilities and help ourselves let go of the idea that we always have to get the right answer. You know, there's a lot of times there's not so much right answers. Is there just, you know, I have a friend who always says, it's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just a thing. You know, there's a lot of things that we just need to take a look at and say, I want to explore this because I'm interested in it. Not because I think this is what I'm supposed to do. This is what I've been sent to Earth to do. It's like, well, how about the fact that you just think it's fun? Why don't you go try it? That seems simple when I say that, but for some people that I'm working with, it's extremely difficult because we're really trained to you know, be very, very, very cautious and don't make those mistakes.
Well, you know, that brings me to, how do you feel as a psychotherapist and people that I've worked with, thousands of clients, I'm sure, about these self-help gurus? And I want to give them a lot of credit because I know that they've really made massive change in people's lives, but that really challenge the wild things, like, you know, skydiving,
right,
or walking through fire and things like that. Is that something that you feel really breaks the hold that fear has upon us?
Those are wonderful metaphors and symbols. I mean, you know, the only problem I have with other self-help people who write self-help books and these people who get out there is if somebody comes out there and says, this is the answer, you know, then I'm going to have a problem with that because I don't think that's very respectful of the fact that we're human beings and there's lots and lots of different avenues toward enlightenment. But in terms of you know, people who write about jumping out of airplanes and walking on fire and stuff, those are wonderful, wonderful, very much affirmations, you know, three-dimensional affirmations. You know, let's do this kind of thing. And I think it's a great thing as long as people – you know, choose it, you know, to be able to say that. Now, what I have been around is some people who tend to be sort of almost cultish with a group like that, and then they're judgmental of people who won't do it. And, you know, I think that's not what that's intended to be. If that's one choice.
Okay.
I know Melody Beatty, who's been kind enough to endorse several of my books through the years, and she writes, I wish I remember which book it was, but she writes in one of her books about the first time that she skydived, and it's hilarious because basically I think the guy she was in tandem with pretty much had to just throw her out of the plane because she changed her mind, you know, which I assume most people do, is why they have a guy attached to your back. But now, of course, you know, she, being a good addict as Melody is, like I am, in recovering addicts, is she skydives all the time. So I think, you know, she describes some wonderful things about addressing fear by doing those kinds of things, and I think it's wonderful.
Well, you know, my children, my son specifically, just decided one day he was going to go skydiving, and of course my daughter went, and you know they're older, they're adults, and a friend of mine as well, and I ended up being the ground person. I ended up being the person that they knew when they saw me coming down that it was for real, and, you know, there was someone
right.
there to support before their feet touched the ground. And I have to say that I didn't even really contemplate it, but possibly there was a fear there, but I think it was more of a disassociation of there are other things that I fear in this world,
uh-huh.
and maybe I need to be making on. Why create another one? So.
Right. And I think disassociation is a good idea. Like if your children are jumping out of airplanes, you're just going to have to numb out. There's no doubt about it.
Well, you know, isn't it funny, right? The only offspring I have, and they had no problem with it, and here I am thinking, if I go, my offspring don't have a mother anymore, possibly.
That's right,
you know?
That's right.
Here I am taking that nurturing stance again. But, you know, let's get into these acronyms, because I think I love acronyms. I come from a telecom background, and that's primarily what the language was. But we all see, you know, fear as false evidence appearing real.
Right.
And you have an acronym that you've put into place, which actually are your four steps.
Right.
Would you mind sharing that with our listeners?
Yeah, face the fear, just using fear as the acronym, face the fear. Explore the fear, accept the fear, and respond to the fear. It all leads back to, as I earlier talked about, response. It's like, first of all, it's all counterintuitive. I mean, the idea that we're asked to turn around and our instinct is to duck and cover or run from what scares us, or fight or flight, or to fight it, you know. And because when I'm talking about facing fear, I'm not talking about going and doing battle with it. I'm talking about, like I said, when I say face it, explore it, means I'm going to listen to it. In the book and in my work with clients and in workshops, I personify the messenger of fear a lot of times as a character I just refer to as the bully. And the bully is that part of us that most all of us have some version of in our head that basically is going to scare us. Basically does two things. He scares us and shames us. He shames us about what we did yesterday, and he'll scare us about what's going to come tomorrow. And so what I want people to do is I want people to sort of be able to separate themselves from the messages of fear. Listen to what you're being told to be afraid of, so that that you then can begin to understand that and make your own choices. So exploring the fear means I'm going to listen to it actually a little bit more objectively. I have people actually write it down. Write down the messages of fear, but don't write them in the first person. Not I am, you know, I am afraid of so-and-so, but Tom, you should be afraid of such-and-such. So that by a client of mine calls it pronoun therapy. Just by changing that little pronoun and having it directly toward me, it makes a big difference, because all of a sudden I'm not identified with the fear. I'm actually in relationship with the fear. And to me, that's where it all begins to change.
Okay, so give us some examples, if you would. I mean, obviously, you know, as a psychotherapist, and I know therapy itself, whether it be psychoanalyzation or psychiatry or anything, are really moving into a different paradigm right now in how they're addressing these issues. I mean, we're no longer going back to where it all started, but we're trying to deal with what's present in the moment.
Right.
So, can you give us an example of what it's like to work with you?
I'm just imagining all the various comments my clients would have at that point. What it's like to work with me.
Sounds like a Facebook thing, right?
Well,
like,
yeah, it might be. One of the things I do is I do a lot of professional training workshops. And one of the things I teach in those training workshops is that we need to integrate, talking about what's newer in this business, we need to be able to integrate our genuine, our authentic personalities into the work we do. A lot of training, traditional psychotherapy training, trains us to keep our own personality outside of the therapy room. So one of the first things I would say about being in therapy with me is you're going to be in therapy with me. I'm going to show up. Now, I always tell my clients, what you pay me for is to keep my most neurotic, crazy self outside of the room. So you're going to get my best self. You're going to get my healthiest self, and you're going to get the focus that I have in this job. But you're going to get the real me, and I'm going to share that. It's not fair that in therapy, when you have one of the beard scratcher therapists that don't say anything and they just sit back and hum-hum at you, well, it's not fair to me that in therapy you're asked to be completely vulnerable, to basically strip down and be, you know, emotionally, psychologically naked, and the therapist doesn't show any vulnerability at all. That doesn't make any sense to me. So part of my process is to say, I'm here to share with you as much as I can. It's about you, not about me. But if there are parts of my personal journey and my own personal therapy or recovery or anything else like that, how that can benefit you, then I'm certainly going to share that openly with you. I want to practice what I teach. I'm not ashamed of the fact that I'm a recovering alcoholic. I'm not ashamed of the fact that I, you know, have experienced years of clinical depression and had treatment for that. It's like those are things that are about my humanity that I'm wide open to sharing with people. And I think that's one of the reasons people come to see me is that they feel I think that feels respectful to them to be able to say, like, this person, basically I see myself as having a whole lot more in common with each client than is different. I'm not better than somebody else. I'm not above, or what my wife says, who's also in this business, is she says to her clients, a beautiful way of putting it, she says, I will work with you but not on you. So I hope that's what one of my clients would say that I do is that, and to me, I'm always telling them it's a collaboration. We're going to get in here together and we're going to work this stuff out. And sometimes that's just going to be about feeling, and sometimes it's going to be about problem solving. It's going to be about whatever it needs to be about. So the other piece I want people to know is when you come into therapy with me, I have my approach to therapy. I have my model of therapy. It even has a name these days. We call it the intrapersonal model. But if that model doesn't fit what you need, then we're going to throw it out the window and find out what works for you. You know, I don't want people to, too often the therapist will, if somebody doesn't fit their way of working, they say, well, this is a resistant client, you know. But there are no resistant clients, in my opinion. There are only inflexible therapists. I mean, we basically have to, our job is to be able to be in that collaboration with people. And if I need to, you know, if you're challenging me in ways, Susie, if you're in therapy with me and you're challenging me in ways that I have not been challenged before, then what I want to do is I want to see, I want to learn with you. I'm going to learn something that I haven't learned before in working with Susie. And we're not going to do what we've always done before. We're going to do this differently, and I hope that's what people's experience is. That's what my feel for it is.
Yeah, you know, I noticed that with coaching too. I think the most benevolent thing that comes out of that whole engagement and that experience is the mutual learning.
Yeah.
And I think what draws me, you know, even further to it is that there's a lot of mirroring that goes on. There's a lot to learn from people, other people's perspectives and their take on things. And you even mentioned that in your book with regard to taking a trip back to your alma mater, mm-hmm. and finding out that there was a message there for you so many years later. How many years later was that?
That was, I think, 25 years after I graduated from that school, you know, and it's... That was really the seed for the book. I had gone back. I'd been asked back to my alma mater, Austin College in Sherman, Texas, where I had gone to undergraduate school, and I had a book out at the time called the Self-Forgiveness Handbook, and I had been asked back to give a lecture there, and I had not been back since I had graduated. That, I don't think it was quite 25, but almost 25 years. And so the night before, I just decided to take the nostalgic stroll across the campus. And I had one of these experiences. I've had these on a number of occasions, and some people look at me sideways with this, but my experience in knowing something about your work, Susie, and hopefully your audience, is I don't have to explain myself to this. It's quite a spiritual experience is what it was. It was a matter of feeling like I had been brought there to the way I put it in the book is to receive a lecture more than to give one. And I really felt this message come through very strongly. And the essence of the message was that you know, Tom, you've done a lot. You've come a long way. Sort of the spirit guides of my life were saying, we're proud of you. You've done this. You're in recovery from this alcoholism. You've fought that. You've done all this therapy. You've worked on yourself. You're in a wonderful second marriage that's actually working. You're doing all these wonderful things. But there's one thing that is still happening here, one central thing that is still happening pretty much exactly as it was when you were here on this campus last time, and that is you're still controlled by fear.
Mm.
And which of course I didn't like to hear that at all. That's just no good. And what I did was, you know, it's one of those things where I got back to the hotel room and just tried to write as fast and furiously as I could to write down what I felt like had been given to me. And anybody who's a writer, I think, sometimes knows those feelings of sometimes there are things I write, and then sometimes there are things I just write down that somebody else is telling me.
Right.
Ironically, since we talked about no fear, if people go to my download page, I have a free download page on my website, and the name of that one is just called No Fear, and it really is the going back to the message we talked about at the beginning. The message of that lecture that I received that evening was, I have to be responsible to step up and say no to fear's control. I can't get rid of it, but I can say no to it.
Okay, can you touch upon, Tom, some of the manifestations that happen in the body that fear generates? You know, fear, if fear is embodying us, it's embodying our whole self.
Right.
So let's say we're going through some tests, some medical tests, and, you know, we've been fortunate to have Bruce Lipton on our show before and really explain the biology of belief and the cell structure and how that's formed. So do you find that some of your clients are dealing mostly on the mental edges of fear, or are some of them dealing with some really chronic physical issues?
Well, I've certainly dealt with people and had people who dealt with chronic physical issues through the years and work with that. And this is certainly not an area that I consider myself an expert on at all, as far as knowing, like what you're talking about with Lipton, knowing the specifics of the inner workings. What I really feel is a very strong respect for the holistic nature of our being, that we're all connected. I had somebody recently come in who felt like she had MS, and her presenting issue was that she believed that it was her fault, that because she had read enough self-help books that told her it was the way she thinks that would cause all of her illness, she was beating herself up thinking she had just caused her MS, which, you know, it's like, I don't care what anybody else tells me, I promise the universe does not work that simply. You know,
right.
It doesn't work that simply. She didn't just make herself have MS. So a lot of the work there actually became about recognizing and respecting, you know, how complex, you know, the physiology of all that is, and all of the various unknowns. Now, the other thing I thought about when you were talking about, though, is from a psychological point of view, some of the training I've gotten since graduate school has helped me be able to really tune into people's sensations in their body to help deal with fear. Well, very often if somebody's feeling something, or especially if they're having trouble being in touch with feelings, I will ask the question, where are you feeling that in your body right now? And interestingly, sometimes you can kind of know before they'll say it. It'll be in their gut or their solar plexus or in the middle of their chest or in the throat. I mean, you can actually see a parallel. I don't know a lot about it, but if you know some about the chakra system, you can also see some parallels with that. But one of the things that I find that people who might have trouble expressing themselves emotionally, verbally, we can go to the body and begin to talk about what that feels like. And maybe something as simple as, okay, if I say, where are you feeling that in your body, Susie? And you say, you know, I had a client one time that said, I feel it in my hands. And so it's just a matter of, I said, okay, what do your hands want to do? You know, and she said, my hands, they want to they want to rip something up. So I gave her this pillow that I thought was pretty indestructible. She ripped it to shreds. It was beautiful. She felt immediately guilty because she was good codependent. You know, I'm so sorry. And I go, no, this is great. You go right ahead. Keep ripping. You know, and so but with that came, you know, all of this anger that she had pent up, that she would tell you the moment when she walked into therapy, she would not have even guessed that she had a lot of anger. But again, through something as simple as focusing on her body and following the lead, what does the body want to do? Or if you say it's in my solar plexus, I might say, you know, is there a movement or is there a sound? Sometimes I use sound to move energy, to move the emotional energy. What kind of sound would that make? And it's amazing how people, once they can get past the embarrassment of that because they're feeling a little self-conscious, how revealing that kind of technique can be, because it, you know, again, we don't always have to put words on it. Sometimes just the feeling, the energy release, the expression of it, we may or may not want to put some words on it later on. But we, you know, we live in a culture where I think we tend to overvalue our intellect a little bit, you know, and think we have to figure it out and we have to put labels on it. Not necessarily. Sometimes what we have to do is just be sure that it gets unstuck. You know, that we address our emotional constipation, really.
Oh, I like that, emotional constipation. You know, it's very strange. Someone just brought up in the chat room. It's not really strange. I'm really relating to it because I sent out an abundance of invitations to this show today. And, you know, you don't want to judge anyone, but I say, you know, there isn't anyone. It's kind of like physical death. You don't know anyone that doesn't experience it.
Right.
Yet people dread dealing with fear, which is a fear in itself. So,
that's
you know,
exactly right.
Why is it? What makes us fear the embarrassment of sharing about our fears?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I think it has to do with. Again, that's a bit of perfectionism, we could call that, or it really comes out of a double standard in a lot of ways. It's like we hold ourselves to this double standard in which, you know, we judge ourselves more harshly than we would other people. You know, and you know, so what happens is, you know, I want to be sure I look good. I want to be sure that I don't do anything to embarrass myself in front of you, but I might ask somebody if you're scared to express something, and I say, well, okay, well, if we were in a group with other people and I encourage somebody else to do that, would you have any problem if they did it? And a lot of times people go like, well, no, I would want them to be able to do it. So sometimes it's about that double standard. I want to back up though to something you said, because it's such a key part of this stuff. And I don't know if this is just pure, this is just the sense of humor of the universe or what it is, but it's like the fear. What we fear most, when I absolutely came away from spending a year and a half working on the fear book and considering and contemplating and thinking and all this stuff about fear, was that as human beings, what we fear most is uncertainty. We hate uncertainty. However, uncertainty happens to be the very nature of life. You know, so I, you know, like I say, the sense of humor of the universe is we tend to have, you know, one of the things that keeps people like me in business and you as a coach probably are people that cannot seem to handle the fact that we don't know what's going to come next. You know, so what we have very often, that's one of the things that we'll have rigid belief systems that develop around there, because a very rigid fundamentalist belief system of any kind is basically set up to tell us that we do know what's coming next. You know, I do understand how the universe works, and I do understand exactly who God is and what God is and how that all works. It's like what that is, in my opinion, is a defense system that says that's there because I can't handle the fact that I don't know what I don't understand. I don't know. We're so scared of I don't know. And it's like that's one of the things that I end up, you know, we talk about those existential conversations. That's one of the things that we face, you know, as all of us do in life, depending on, you know, different circumstances that arrive, or even just the aging process. You know, as we get older, you know, I'm 55 years old. my experience with all of that is different than it was when I was 35 years of age. It's like the understanding at 55 that, you know, I understood intellectually at 35 that everybody dies. At 55, I'm pretty sure if I look close enough, I can see people dropping off the edge up there over ahead of me. You know, it becomes more real, the time limitation, all these things. These things are and we don't know what's to come. Now, go back to the primary theme that we started off with, is what our challenge is to take that fear of not knowing what's to come, and that fear of life itself, and say, okay, now what I want to do with this instead of just sitting here being afraid of what might come, I want to be someone who chooses what I'm going to do next. And I don't mean we control everything, but basically I call it being in charge. It's like there's a difference between being in control and being in charge. You know, you don't get to control what cards are dealt you, but you can become a good card player. And so what I want people to do is I want people to say, okay, no matter what life is dealing you, you know, if you want power in your life, what you want to be able to do, no matter what's life dealing, including whatever messages you've grown up with fear inside, you know, or out, inside you, what you want to be able to do is be the person who says, I'm in charge of taking all of this raw data, all this raw information that has been programmed in and around me, and then I'm going to begin a process of living my life by decision rather than default. I'm going to live that conscious life where I am going to make choices, you know, not always the ones I think, I'm not going to always think they're going to be absolutely right, they're the correct choices, but whatever choice I make, I'm going to make it, and I'm going to own it, and it's going to say it's my choice. I'm no longer going to delegate that to somebody else or claim to be a victim to the rest of the world. All of that, by the way, easier said than done.
Yes. Well, that's part of the whole inner work, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want
people to tell that because sometimes people will read one of my books, or I try to reflect the hard work in the books, but you can read a self-help book and people will judge themselves and say, well, you know, Charlie in your chapter 4, he seemed to get this, you know, and all together. And, you know, and I said, well, chapter 4 was like 19 pages. Charlie was in therapy for 5 years. You know, it's like, so, you know, don't judge yourself by that. And I also always love the phrase you hear in 12-step meetings a lot of times, things are simple but not easy. So
right.
the things I'm describing, you know, they're easy for me to say, and I can say, okay, this is what we were shooting for. But these are the very things that, and again, that I'm challenged to deal with and live my life according to that every single day. I have no mastery over what I just described. You know, I'm better than I used to be, and I have a commitment to let that be my daily practice, to live a life by decision and to not be a victim, you know. But some days are better than others. I do better on some days than others.
Right.
As we all do.
Well, you know, it's funny because when you think about it, it is very simple to apply. I think that it's a stretch of being easy in the understanding of it and the sorting out that we need to be doing, you know, especially with regard to this healthy fear and unhealthy fear. We did have a question in the chat room I'd just like to bring up briefly because there's a couple things I'd love to cover with you. And believe it or not, we're like kind of running out of time already.
that's because we're having fun.
Yes, and Red Gypsy in our chat room would like to know, how about something on the relationship of moving from fear to anger?
Okay. Well, there's several guys on my committee began to speak all at once. They all have different ideas about that. There's a if I wish we were talking voice to voice here, we could have a conversation about that with her. But the first thing that comes to my mind is the idea that many people, everybody seems to have, in my opinion, this is an oversimplification too, but it seems to me everybody tends to have a lead emotion. This is just something I've been working with recently. My lead emotion tends to be anger and judgment. So if something happens I don't like, the reflex response I'm going to feel myself get pissed off, and there's going to be judgmental thinking. It's like, well, how dare that guy do so and so and so and so. I have a good friend whose lead emotion is always fear. No matter what happens, what's going on like that, her tendency is to be afraid first. Now, whatever your lead emotion is, I have another friend whose lead emotion is guilt. No matter what happens, no matter what it has to do with, she somehow feels guilty about it. So, but whatever it happens to be in terms of the relationship between the fear and the anger, for instance, is that I really think that people who have a lead, they have the lead, I have the lead emotion of anger. My challenge has been to go underneath that and find the fear, you know, and deal with the fear. If somebody has the lead emotion, and it's not that the anger is not legitimate, and it's not that all of these emotions are legitimate, but if somebody's lead emotion is fear, very often their challenge is to go under there and find their anger, because within that anger, their fear is usually is very likely keeping them from taking the power of owning their own power, whereas the anger underneath there will likely help them be able to do that. So what we do is we lead with the feeling we're most comfortable with. And often the feeling we're, you know, and often that is, even though it's a legitimate feeling, it's associated with some kind of defense process for us. So what we're looking for is how can I access those feelings I am least comfortable with? Because that's probably where the harder work is.
Okay. Well, that makes perfect sense to me.
Well, I love things that make perfect sense. That's good, Susie.
Yeah, it does.
Write that down and sign it and send it over to me. I made perfect sense one day.
It does, because you know what? I've been there, and I you put it in such a very simplistic form of understanding for me, so it
good.
Works for me.
Good.
I don't know how many other people out there it's relative to.
It's an interesting exercise. Like I say, I've just been working on this. I'm writing an article about it right now because I've just been thinking about it. But I'd be interested if people have this is one of those things where if people want to, they can contact me through the website or through Facebook or that kind of stuff. If people have reflections on that idea of what their lead emotion is, what that reflex emotion is for them, I'd be interested in it because I really have been. Goes with that is that what do you feel like is the your least comfortable emotion that you're basically running from?
Okay. Actually, I have someone in the chat room that is thinking about calling in and asking a question. So we'll wait to see if they show.
Okay.
I'd like to get into if we could. With regard to number one, on an intimate level, with regard to parents,
uh-huh.
You know, and I want to look at them as parents as fear advisors, because
uh-huh.
you bring up the fear advisors in the book.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to address parents very briefly about, you know, how fear wants us to fill in the blanks, and our parents kind of during our upbringing have really conditioned us to watch out, that'll kill you, don't do this,
right.
Don't do that. And we really have to look at the severity, like you said, in exploring the difference between healthy fear and,
right.
you know, fantasy fear or whatever it is
right.
that you want
right.
to call it.
I have a friend who and very often this is associated with the parent the family of origin because often the parents and the adults in the child's life kind of program this, but you talk about the fantasy part is she says on her committee that she has a character that she refers to as the director of fiction, and this is the character who writes scary stories to tell her. You know, always scary ones. No positive, wonderful stories. Just scary stories of all the scary things that might happen, and how you know my story might be. Okay, well you've talked to Susie, but now that Susie gets to know you a little bit better, I know she doesn't like you anymore, and da da da. That goes on and on and on. And so very often we have to, we do have to intervene and find out that present day version of that belief system, those belief systems, and track it back. You know. I'm not a therapist that says we always have to go back and find out, you know, everything about our family of origin, but I think of our family of origin as, in one of my books called Simple Truth, the one you mentioned, there's a chapter in there that describes the metaphor of family of origin as your alma mater. This is the place, this is the school where you learned how to be you. It's not a matter of we're going to judge them, they're bad. People are very often afraid we're going to judge the family. I just want to know how you learned these things. And I want to know, you know, if you're afraid of something, then somehow you learned it somewhere. You know, and that's okay. What we're just figuring out is how you learned it, not to judge the person who taught you. you know. But to see, because if we can understand where you learned it, it may give us some information to help you begin to think differently.
Okay. Okay. You know, we have someone on hold, so I'd like to bring them forth. But before we do, I just want to alert our listeners that you can visit Tom's website at www.tom, and that's T-H-O-M, as in Mary, Rutledge, RUTLEDGE.com. And you could also visit Tom on Facebook. He has a wonderful page there, a wonderful group, and of Nutshells of Wisdom, which we're already connected. I see that common thread there, Tom.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you having all this wonderful resources, these resources for people to tap into.
Oh, absolutely.
And I'd like to bring on our caller.
Okay.
And let's see now. Hi, 206-313, you're on the air.
Hello, it's Teresa.
Hi, Teresa.
How are you, hon?
I'm great. You have
wonderful.
A question? Tom, right?
I do. Let's see. I've got a scenario for you, Tom.
Okay.
And hopefully this can enlighten me, enlighten, and maybe a couple other people out there. Getting angry and getting angry in the aspect of being defensive. So here's the scenario. Somebody has went through your phone records to see who it is that you've been talking to. And although you know you haven't done anything wrong, it's actually quite funny, but the anger immediately comes to the surface, and not necessarily, you know, the name calling and accusational stuff, but more, I guess it's more of a crossing the boundaries as far as self-respect and that type of a thing, but it comes across as defensive, almost to where you look guilty because you are reacting the way that you are.
Right.
So it almost like bites you in the butt for the way that you're reacting when
right.
you know that it's really just because, you know, hey, that's mine.
Mm.
Why are you looking at my stuff type of a thing?
Absolutely. Well, there's a lot of things there, Teresa. I mean, one of the first things that comes to my mind, though, is, and it doesn't sound like you necessarily need a whole lot of validation here, but I think it's a lot of people will in that situation is to know that what the situation you described, anger is a completely sane and understandable response. And, you know, if somebody
right.
is violating you like that, it's like, and you're not angry, then I'm going to go. Then we're going to say, well, okay, well, now we got a problem. What's going
right.
on with that is I think there's a part of that too, though, that where, you know, you make your judgment call. It's
mm-hmm.
like you're going to sound defensive because you're defending.
Right.
Right? It's like, because, again, one of the things that happens is
it's
we
a natural type of an instinct, you know.
Well, and it's normal. It's right. It's correct.
Right.
It's like, if I'm being attacked, I'm going to defend. It's like, you know, one of the things that happens in our world is that of too much psychotherapy is we turn everything into pathology. And every
right.
time we talk about somebody being defensive, it doesn't mean it's pathological. It doesn't mean it's a problem. If I've been violated and I am defensive, then that's actually a sane response. So the idea there, what I would, you know, probably end up working with you on is, you know, if as long as you are doing what you feel is right for you, in other words, defending, being angry, expressing the anger in a way that feels like it is legitimate and justified and proportional to you, what I would probably work with you on is letting go of your need to have that other person understand that. It's like, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's a little slogan in AA that says, what other people think of me is none of my business.
Right.
And
I love
sometimes
it.
You got to be able to say, you know what, I'm not going to sit here and defend my defensiveness. I'm, you know, if that seems
correct.
Defensive to you, it's because I'm defending myself because, you know, you're the a-hole that violated my space.
Right. So, but here's the thing, though. I mean, you know, well, I know this, and I walk through it, yet there is no time frame between I'm fine and then, boom, it's like, you know, the gates have opened and the race has begun, so the emotions are there before the thought process kicks in. And so it's not always that the anger is being represented in a manner that probably is correct,
right?
Right?
Yeah,
so
well,
it's like an explosion, and then when I'm coming back down, it's like, wow, okay, I guess I did overreact, but yet I don't feel like I really have to apologize in the aspect of what I was angry about, probably more so the way that I was angry, right?
Right, exactly. It's like, I doubt seriously that you overreacted, but one of the great things that I learned a long time ago that just made a world of difference for me is that I could do exactly what you just said. I can apologize for how I said something without apologizing for what I said. So that's an important part to go back and clean that up. The other thing, though, that can be improved over time is that reflex. I don't think we change our reflexes. I think our reflexes are kind of going to be there. But what we do in this process is I use the metaphor of the committee a lot of times in our consciousness. And what I suggest to people do is we work on installing what I call a gatekeeper. So you just need somebody there at the gate that gives you a few moments of pause so when the raging angry one comes running to the door, the gatekeeper says, "Hold on, wait just a minute. We are pissed off and we are going to deal with this, but we're not letting you do it."
Yeah.
And then we go through it. It takes a lot of practice. Again, easier said than done, but it's like that kind of stuff can improve over time because I just identify with you because I've gotten myself in a world of trouble through my life by reacting with anger, reflexively without thinking at all.
Mm. Well, I've lived that the majority of my life is always being on the defense. And as I've gotten into the enlightenment and spirituality stuff, I have learned how to curb that. But I've found it quite interesting that as I'm coming into my 40s, the emotions and the change that I'm going through physically, it's the emotions sometimes are jumping out before I have the chance to really stop them. It's like they're there, and then I have to work backwards to say, okay, so I acted like a complete idiot just now, and, I wrote out the emotion, but yet I have to try and save face with certain people because they're all all looking at me like, okay, what just happened there? Because it's like I'm one person and then I'm somebody else, and then I come back and I'm like, oh, I'm really sorry. I don't know who that just was.
Well, a couple of things about that. One is, certainly, you seem to be doing a good job of accepting responsibility for what, you're going, I'm the one that's going to have to work this stuff out. The other thing, though, is the part of that is you're going to work it out by allowing yourself to experiment. And so to do that, you're going to be clumsy. When we're learning anything, we're going to be clumsy. It sounds like you have some friends that can be forgiving, and that's a very nice thing to have.
I do have friends that are forgiving, but in my closer relationships, not so.
Okay.
Also realize, too, that, as we are working on our things, so are other people working on theirs. So it might not always be us, and, our reaction might not necessarily be 100% us, and vice versa,
Right.
We're kind of feeding off each other's energies and whatever's happening with that happening that day, and there's all kinds of factors that kind of come into play.
Well, we always want to own our side. We want to take care of our side of the street, but that doesn't mean that. One of the things I've learned is that we can have another reaction. People who are in a personal growth path go so far into do that where I call it too much therapy. You have too much therapy when you have what I call pathological fairness. Where it's where you're going, you're acting like, oh no, this must be mine. I got to do this. Sometimes it's not. I do not want to give up that. If you're the one that screwed this up, Teresa, I want to be able to say that. That if that's my opinion, because otherwise we can get in. It goes back to that bypass thing that Susie was talking about. Then we can sort of want to transcend and be these little spiritual gurus, who don't just talk like human beings. And I don't want to lose the ability. I don't want to get so caught up in the jargon of therapy that I can't say, Teresa, I think you need to work on that.
Right.
I could be wrong, but I want to be able to say that to you.
If that's where you are at that place, yeah.
Right.
No, this is fascinating because we are physical, we are human beings, as well as spiritual. So it's finding that balance and making them work for us and still being realistic with the fact that we have to deal with, who we are on a day-to-day basis.
Oh, yeah, that realistic thing. That's the monkey wrench right there.
Yeah. But it all can definitely work for ourselves. Yeah. But, I encountered that last night and I've kind of played with it. I don't judge myself as much anymore, but I've kind of tossed it around to say, that was interesting. That was really interesting the way that I reacted, because if I was on the receiving end of the way that I reacted, I probably would have thought too, wow, you know, maybe you did do something wrong that I need to be watching because of, you know, they always say the person who is accusing and who really jumps to the guard off the bat looks like they're guilty
mm-hmm.
versus somebody who says, no, I didn't do that. And
right.
they're just quiet and meek and mild.
Right, right.
So I've kind of toyed with it all night. So I thought this would work perfectly as a scenario for maybe somebody else, too, who's
yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
working through the anger. So thank you.
Thank
and
you.
Thanks for this show. I got the invite, and I'm late, but I'm glad that I caught what I could.
Oh, thank you, Teresa. I really honor your presence here and you know, stepping up to the plate. And I just loved the entire conversation that I had to go and extend the show because we were already 2 minutes over.
Well, you know, it's so funny because as spiritual, you know, people that are really moving into the world of enlightenment, I do think that we, if you're really, really being true with yourself and walking the path, it is hard at times to really be honest and say, hey, you know what? I'm not all that all the time. I'm just like the rest of you guys. I might be a little more, I'm really real with myself at the most deepest, core level, but not everybody sees that. You know, that's an internal thing. So when you do have to work through the things on an outward basis, you know, it helps other people to know that, oh, okay, so I exploded last night in anger, and that doesn't mean I'm a bad person. Wow, that's really cool. So, I mean, you know, we're human. Everybody has emotions, and that's how we grow is by writing out the emotions, not pushing them away, not trying to say I'm bad for having them. And it's not. It is all about love, and yet, you know, that's not the only emotion that we have, right? We have anger and anxiety and excitement and...
Right, and to have all of those is not to see. I think a lot of times people oversimplify that to be spiritual is to always be at peace and this stuff. But to me, I ask people to measure your progress and measure how you're doing today by how tuned in you are to the truth
right.
about you. If the truth about me today is I am furious, then I am being true to myself to be furious. It's like
Absolutely.
Rather than I'm supposed to say, no, I'm not. I must not be spiritual today because I'm not peaceful. Because like you said, and Susie made some comments earlier too. It's like we need to. One the thing we have to accept is that we're human beings. You
right.
know, we're planted here on Earth, and we have these these limitations, and there's nothing wrong with them.
Right, and to you know, and like you said, and to be true with that. I mean, when we say. I've gotten to the point instead of trying to look like everything's perfect on the outside and just stuffing
right.
and being the strong person on the exterior as I'm crumbling inside, you know.
Yeah, right.
And then when somebody happens to be the unlucky person that hits that last button,
right.
they get the volcano, you know. And it's so as instead of living that way, you know, always being on the brink of exploding,
uh-huh.
and letting everybody think I'm just this wonderful person that never gets angry, it's now the realistic part of saying, hey, guess what, guys? I'm being bitchy today. I don't feel good. I don't know why. But if this is the way that it is, hopefully in an hour it's gone. But,
right.
I just say, hey, here's what it is. It's not you. It's me. But if you don't want to be around it, back off.
You've done a good job with that, Teresa, because I'm scared of you.
It's not that bad.
Whatever you do, don't upset
it's all
Teresa.
Good. I'm a good person. No, I really am. But I am. I'm honest, you know. And with that honesty, you know, it's sometimes it's brutal to have to go through and really admit to yourself that, you know, I was really rude just then, or you know, that was uncalled for what I just did. And then I think it's all about the personal accountability. I mean, it really is. When we take that. Stop pointing the finger at somebody else and saying, you know, one thing that really gets me is when somebody says, I wouldn't have done that if you hadn't have pissed me off. If you hadn't have said that, I wouldn't have gotten angry. And it's like, it wouldn't have mattered what anybody would have said. They are not in control of how you react.
Right.
So because that's one of my pet peeves, I constantly look at it and say, I am not allowed to point the finger at somebody else and say that they made me angry. They might have triggered something to make me angry, which I know now is probably a really good thing because something obviously needed to be released at that time. that I need to work on. Something needs my attention, but it's not their quote-unquote fault that I got angry. And if they had done something different, then I wouldn't have gotten angry. It's time to stop doing that. So, I mean, that's one of my things that I think, no more pointing the finger. It's time to look at you and see what it was that just got triggered and figure out, you know, was it just a spur-of-the-moment thing that you've been holding stuff in, or is it something that maybe you need to look a little closer at? Or maybe it wasn't mine at all, you know? Maybe it was them, and I let it be mine.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so. You know, and Teresa, that's so true. It really is, because when we get to that point and that awareness just flushes over us, and then we have the chance, like Tom said, right there in the moment, you have that choice.
Yeah.
You're making
it. And we really do.
Yeah.
So just kind of step back and look at things from an objective outsider's view. And if you have the opportunity to really, and it takes practice, it really does, to be, you know, the gatekeeper and be the one that's having the emotion to stop and say, okay, stop. We know that you're angry, but, you know, is this the time? Is this the place? Is this the person? Is it them? Is it you? I mean, can you just stop for a second and take a breath? And usually, if you can have enough clarity in that, you know, split second to just stop and take a breath, it'll kind of refocus and you'll think, wow, okay, I'm fine. Or you might not. You might just say, no, I'm going to go off. I need to go off. This is, you know, this is how I'm feeling in the moment, and this person needs to hear it. So be it. But it is about, it's cool when you can really sit back in that split second and not evaluate per se, but to just, I guess, just stop. Just stop for a brief second, take a breath, and then go.
You know, I'm an advocate for what happens when you don't allow what Teresa is explaining. You know, back in the early 90s, and I had just, in the late 80s, I stepped onto my spiritual path and started asking a bunch of questions. And I was, you know, in an industry where motivation was key. And it was really after about a year and a half of not allowing myself to have a bad day, I actually entered a hospital for rehabilitation because I absolutely had a nervous breakdown.
Absolutely.
So, and it was just about, you know, and I think a lot of people on their spiritual journeys are making that connection also, where they're saying, oh, I must be good and I must be able to accept everything and everyone, you know, because acceptance is key. That's what's going to, you know, unify this world. It's going to unify humanity. But there are steps that we have to get there. And I think the acceptance really comes into knowing that this is a process and that we each have our individual timing on our own paths. And I think that's where acceptance comes in, not having to accept that you need to be this perfect, altruistic, you know, alchemic type of person that is releasing or trying to shed their humanity, their own humanity. I mean, that's why we're here. So I love it, Teresa, that, you know, bringing the spiritual down for practical use, for practical people, and to really finding the blend and the balance to be able
to.
You
have to, because, you know, as you know, when you were seeking, you know, like you said, once you begin that path and you think, well, if I have a bad day or if I judge somebody, then I must not be as spiritual as I claim to be. And, you know, that's not true, because we have to experience the absolute dark, dark place within ourselves to be able to really feel and live the light. You would not ever know what it's like to live in that light if you've never lived in the dark. You know, to feel that excruciating pain within.
It begins
to open up that seed of saying, wow, the sun's out today. Oh, thank you. I'm so grateful that the sun's out and the wind's blowing. It just makes me, for all the dark times and the dark experiences, I've grown that much more. And I appreciate and I'm grateful for every little piece that I've had to endure. And that takes nothing away from how, I mean, I was on the edge of wanting to end my life many, many times, contemplating it to, you wouldn't believe how I would sit down and think about how I was going to end my life until I just let go. And my mind was too, like you said, which I think a lot of women and mothers have a tendency to do is thinking that they have to be superwoman, you know, and not taking away from the men, because I think men do on another level, thinking they've got to hold the world up, being the provider and, you know, the big, tough, strong guy, and nobody can see him have any emotions. And so we've all got our own things, but women, I think, are just expected to go, 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 and they never get any downtime for themselves.
Well, that's because we don't have caves.
Well, yeah, that's true. But we don't let ourselves. We need to be willing to give ourselves the permission to stop and play. And you know what? This is my time, guys. And just, you know, pamper yourself and just stop stuffing it and just be real with yourself and everybody else in your life and say, you know what? This is my day. I feel like I just am being a bitch. And guess what? I'm going to go with it. So if you're not in the mood for me, then you might as well leave the room now, because it is what it is right now. And usually when you open that door, you don't resist it. You don't hide it. You don't, you know, lie about it. Once you open the door and say, okay, I'm going to be a bitch, it's gone. It's there and it's gone. It's like you've just opened the door and the breeze just let it come and flushed it right back out. And the next thing you know, you're back to normal again.
Right.
Yeah. You know, Teresa, this is, we should get together and do a show on this specifically.
Yeah, I would love that. Yeah. I mean, it's so deep and yet it's so simple.
Well, there's a few people that have commented in the chat room that I'd like to bring up to Teresa. So if that's okay.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed having you on the show. And just to remind everybody that we are on the air with Tom Rutledge. And now Teresa has called in with some really great, stimulating conversation. So, Tom.
Yes, I'm right here.
Just to remind our listeners again, Tom's website is www.tom, and that's T-H-O-M as in Mary, Rutledge, RUTLEDGE.com, and he's got some really wonderful resources on there, as well as, can they purchase the book from your site also, Tom?
They can. Actually, Simple Truth is only available through my site. They can get that one there, and you just go to the bookstore on my website, and you can order Embracing Fear either through the website or through Amazon if you have the choice of doing it one or the other. So, but no buyer will be turned away.
Okay. Well, thank you. And actually, thanks, Live Conversations, for putting that link up in the chat room as well. But here's another question that we have, since we have a little bit of time to dabble here. To remember that perfection isn't static, and that's ever-changing and ever-flowing.
Right.
And that's by was presented by Life Conversations in the chat room, Tom. So I'd like you to comment on this expansion that we're all going through. And, you know, maybe to touch upon what Teresa said about acceptance along the way.
Well, yeah, I like the idea that you know, when there's all kinds of different ways that we can kind of trick ourselves into thinking in terms of perfectionistic kinds of things. I like the idea that perfection is fluid, not static. Again, this has to do with the big fear I said earlier about the fear of uncertainty. We tend to act like things are permanent. We actually equate safety with things that are familiar. You know, this is one of the, even if they're negative, even if they're self-destructive. And you talk about
people, call that being comfortable with the uncomfortable.
Absolutely, way too comfortable a lot of
mm-hmm.
times to do that. So I like the idea that we, in this case, redefine perfection. You know, it's like, again, it's like, let's be, if we're going to say, just for the sake of our conversation, let's say there's a definition of being a perfect human being, which involves a tremendous amount of radical imperfection. You know, the idea is if we're being a perfectly good human being, a perfectly productive human being, not being stuck, but we're in a process of learning, we are going to be imperfect in every which way, and it's like that's the way we learn. And so, without being able, you know, I often think like our difficulties and our imperfections and how we screw things up, this is how we learn in life. And so I make the analogy that it's like if we come to Earth Earth is the gym, and we are the spirits who are coming to work out on Earth. It's like, you know, you think about it, you don't go to the gym and then complain about the weights being so heavy.
You know, or just stand around.
You don't just go
watching everybody else work out and wondering why you're not building any muscle.
Actually, that's what I would do. Just go around and chat everybody else up. But it's like, you don't go like, I don't want to lift that weight. It's so heavy. It's like, that's the point, you know. So the point of life is to do that. And I don't mean we need to seek struggle for struggle's sake. We've all known those people, and some of us have been those people, where it's sort of like, you know, we become, you know, drama queens and kings, and we just seem to seek that out. But it's like... But beyond that, you know, there is going to be drama. There are going to be, you know, the stories in our life are going to involve conflict and mistakes. What I want to see is that people are able to learn. I have one of my little nutshells we talked about says learn from the past, then get the hell out of there.
Yeah. I love that button, Tom. And what was the other one? I'm a perfectionist.
I'm a recovering perfectionist. That's right.
Oh.
Okay.
I'm perfect in all my imperfections.
Yeah, I'm radically, perfectly imperfect, whatever.
I like that.
Addie, thank you for that one. Okay, Tom, I'd like to just spread now. We're all into the individualistic and then looking at, let's take a look at the bigger picture. And really, you know, what contributions are we making to the collective consciousness out there with regard to our fears? Why is it so important for us to make it through our own fears?
I think I appreciate you saying that, because there's a by the way, I want people to know that embracing fear, you can download the entire first chapter from my website. So you can get a free sample before you read the book, before you decide if you want to buy it. But in that chapter, that's exactly one of the things I talk about, is the fact that the reason, you know, to focus on our dealing with our own fears, the reason to focus on our own self-growth, is so that we can heal and reconnect to community, to grow. Because a lot of times, you know, you mentioned the 80s. I was coming up professionally in the 80s, and I mean, that was just, you know, it was the mentality of that was, you know, self gain for self gain's sake, and it was me. They call it the me decade.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's like, I think what we've come to now is we've come away from that and go like, okay, well, none of that's worth anything unless I'm using who I am to reconnect to the bigger picture. And so, I, you know, I want people to see that. I just use the metaphor often, or the image of ripple effect. It's like the better care I take of myself, which means I'm going to be in touch with my value system, and part of my value system is about contributing to, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, in a particular way, contributing to the health of my family, to the health of my community, to my colleagues here in my office, you know, all the way out into the same principles apply all the way out into global politics.
Okay.
I have one of my articles on the website's called Respect is the missing ingredient in politics. You know, the fact that there isn't that element in politics is so often what the problem is. So it is anyway, long way around the block. I think I'm just mainly agreeing with you. We must connect back into the community in order to
what we're doing individually.
Yeah, but the idea is sometimes people, that's also part of the bypass. You said before.
Mm-hmm.
I know we all know people, and I'm not saying they don't contribute a lot, but a lot of times who give and give and give and give and give and give to other people, but they are in a state of constant depletion.
Right.
Because they don't know. They don't know. It's not that the giving is not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. I just think what we have to give is so much more powerful when it comes from the inside out. I have a little prayer right here on my desk that is, I like simplicity. So one of the things that it has is just very simple. It says, God bless me and God bless everybody I touch today.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to point out to my clients a lot of times is I put myself first in that prayer for a reason. It's like, I want to, you know, because that's the counterintuitive part. That's against sort of a lot of the religious teachings we have, is I want to bring in my I would call it the God allowance. I want to bring that energy into me and then use that to share from that place, rather than tell myself, you deserve it, I don't.
Mm, yeah. That's powerful. And that's so true, too.
Yeah.
So true. And you know what? More and more, the be the change you wish to see in the world. I mean, how true is it that it has to start with us?
That's right.
You have to bring it back to you. And I was thinking as you were talking that it's even as simple, well, it's simple, but it's huge, as by me taking care of me, I am an example for those that witness that. And it's not in a selfish, I'm going to take care of me and neglect you type of a thing. It's more, the more I take care of me, the more I have for you.
Right. Well, and
so even my daughters and my children witness that, and that's a healthy way of showing them, not telling them, as we were grown up to be told things and never shown, don't drink, don't smoke, don't swear, don't do this, don't do that. Yet as we're witnessing our parents do the complete opposite, you know, don't do as I do,
right,
do as
right,
I say.
Right, right.
That the kids know better. They watch. They don't. They aren't hearing anything you're saying. They're paying attention to what you're doing. And when you're really living an authentic life and being, you know, there in all wholeness with yourself, you are showing them a healthy way of not only contributing to themselves and living a long, healthy life on this earth, but as you said, being the start of that ripple effect to touch everybody else that comes into contact with them and outward, doing something to contribute in a positive way by living intentionally, living purposefully.
That's so,
and it all comes back full circle. So that's the win-win about it. The more you give, the more you get back. So it's not hurting anything. And giving in a way, like you said, it's not giving in a way that you're depleting yourself.
No,
but it's about finding the balance of knowing when to receive as well.
Right. You know, if you
you should write a book.
If you want to keep
I just
it,
did a show on the giving and receiving, so I love how it's come back.
Yeah.
Back around to this, because it's so important. You know, we think that we've got to give, and how come we're so tired, and how come we're sick, and how come nobody's giving back? You know, and it's not coming back, and we're never happy with it. Well, I never took time for myself. I mean, I didn't even think of myself, let alone stop and do something for myself. So, you know, we do it to ourselves. We have to realize that we're the ones that are in control of all this. We have the choice to do one thing or another. And when you stop and actually realize that, you know, it all comes down to me, I can decide to be angry today, or I can decide to be happy, or I can decide to not give anything to anybody, or I can do some random act of kindness for somebody. It's finding where that intention lies at that moment for me, and then I know that when I set that, it's an automatic flow on its own. I don't have to control it. Once I'm in my right place, it just goes through me.
Well, that's living through the clarity of your own example. And I think that as parents, especially, you know, you got to think when we send our kids to school, and there's, you know, if we stay in that space, I'm not sure what happens to the kids when they get to school. You know, not everyone's
not
mindful of that. So
it's
that's a good thing.
Topic
for another day.
Absolutely, would be a 4-hour topic.
Yeah. And you know what? We'll get there. We will get there. Tom, I just wanted to press upon another thing about comments that you've made, and actually your belief or your summation of the movie The Secret. And when we're talking about manifestations and exactly what your take is on this with regard to fear.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that. I have enough objections to the book and the movie The Secret that I created a website specifically for that. It's just called thesecretantidote.com, and it has many things on it, but it centers around what an article I wrote called The Antidote to the Secret, and I think, although it's very clear my bias about this, if people, I always hope it's all free, so there's nothing to buy there. It's just you know, the antidote. I always say the antidote is free. It's my. It's, you know, there's a lot to say about it, but the main point is The Secret is a wonderful example of how self-help writers, in a self-serving way, oversimplify things and claim to have ultimate answers. And this is fine for the vast majority of us. Most of us are sorting through that fine, positive thinking, got it, do all this other stuff we're talking about. But as a psychotherapist, I'm telling you, I'm sitting here talking to people day in and day out who already blame themselves for so many horrible things that they're not to blame for. Sexual abuse victims, rape victims, other kinds of physical abuse victims. The woman I mentioned earlier with MS. All these people, you know, and what this book will literally tell them, and if you go look at it and go read the website, it will tell them that everything that's wrong with them is their fault. It's because of their thinking. And it's like, all I want from those people who contributed to The Secret is to come out and put their disclaimer on it. These are just our opinions. We have no way of having access to the truth of how the universe works. This power of the law of attraction is not the most powerful law in the universe. I mean, the way I put it in the website is, I'm pretty sure if we put this to Stephen Hawking, he's not going to sign off on it. And I tend to think that Stephen Hawking is a little bit smarter than Jack Canfield.
or even David Hawking at that point.
That's true. Exactly.
You know,
well, obviously, I have lots of feelings about The Secret.
we need to remember that that's only a piece. And the thing was, for me, on my journey, is that opened a huge door for me.
Yeah.
But I knew, without knowing, I guess, that there was more, and I went deeper.
Right.
A lot of people that I've met, like you said, that took that as complete.
Right.
You know, this is the whole picture, and if I'm not doing it this way, then I've definitely screwed up in life.
It's the Hippocratic Oath. It's like, first, do no harm. Those of us who write these self-help books are responsible to people to not do that. I would never put something out there that said, this is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and I have the absolute, and if you don't do this, you're wrong. It's like that is, you know, that's unethical. It's unfair, and there are things in that book that will kill people. People think I'm a drama queen about this. It tells you that cancer is caused by wrong thinking. That's all it's caused by. All it takes is one person who puts off going to the doctor because they're trying to correct their thinking, puts off going to the doctor long enough to get that cancer get ahead of them, and they're dead. You know, it's like, so, and I give lots of other examples on the website. It's like, these people are not being responsible to put out there and just say the things that most every other person, like you say, most of us read that and go, like, I got it. You know, I've been reading the power of positive thinking since Norman Vincent Peale back in the 50s. You know, it's all wonderful stuff. I'm not questioning positive thinking. I'm not, you know, I do prefer that we also talk about positive action, which, by the way, The Secret never mentions.
Right.
There is no action. And they also barely mention, we talk about community, they barely mention giving to the bigger world. Everything about The Secret is about gaining for yourself. You know,
You know what, Tom, I hate to interrupt you. We have a less than 2 minutes left.
Okay.
I can extend it if you like.
No, I want everybody, if they don't mind me ranting a little bit, just go to the website, thesecretantidote.com, and I'll appreciate it.
Okay, because, you know, we could extend another 30 minutes.
actually, my wife is waiting for me, so I...
Okay. Oh, I so appreciate you. I mean, this was an awesome conversation, and thank you, Teresa, for coming in and,
you know,
sharing with us and being a part of this, as well as all our listeners in the chat room and on the phone. We really appreciate your presence, and thank you again, Tom. And again, it's tomrutledge.com.
Right.
And thesecretantidote.com.
Right.
And I'd like to announce, please don't miss next week's show, as we'll be journeying with Jill Bolt Taylor, who is a brain scientist who actually witnessed her own stroke and entered a level of consciousness that was completely mind-boggling. So we're looking forward to journeying with Jill next week on Wisdom Wide Open Radio. And thanks again, everyone, for listening.
Thank
you. And we hope you have a wonderful week.
On. Get in touch with me, and thank you, Tom. I'll let you say your goodbyes, honey.
No, I appreciate it very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Okay, Tom.
Have
and
a beautiful day.
We'll be seeing you again in the future, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
All right. Take care, everyone. And remember, find the joy in enjoying your journey. Thank you so much.